Well, before we begin, a few opening remarks. Thank you for participating remotely today with us, Mr. Valen. We do have this ability to do our arguments remotely, but the same rules that would be in effect if we were in person at the Minnesota Judicial Center still apply. I want to make sure you're able to see the clock. So if you're in what we call gallery view, you should be able to see not just the video feed that each of the judges is sharing, but you should also be able to see the clock so you know how much time you have remaining during your argument. We also understand that from time to time there could be some technical difficulties or an interruption. We'll do our best to keep them to a minimum, but if something like that happens, let us know and we'll accommodate you to the best we can to make sure you get all the time to which you're entitled. And last, before you begin, if you would please pronounce your name and your client's name for us, and then let us know what, if any, preferences you have that we should be aware of when we're referring to you and your client.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is John Valen, V-A-L-E-N. I'm an attorney up here in Walker. I will try to suppress my cough as we're breathing Canadian smoke up here this morning. My client is Lavinia Coleman. She too goes by her middle name of Holly Coleman. And she was the applicant in this matter, an application to change the name of her 16-year-old transgender child from Tony Michelle Johnson to William Oliver Coleman, and I will refer to him as Oliver, his chosen name. The application was brought by Oliver's mother, Holly Coleman, who resides here in Hubbard County. She's divorced from Oliver's father, Mr. Johnson. And Oliver has been living with his mother for almost 2 years now. The notice of the application was given to Oliver's father, Mr. Johnson. He opposed that. As I understand the statute, consent is not required, but it does raise the bar with regard to the level of proof needed here. And with his opposition, we need to present clear and compelling evidence that Oliver's substantial welfare necessitates this name change. And of course, we submit that it does. It isn't entirely clear to me the basis for the opposition or the breadth, you might say, of the opposition by Mr. Johnson. The transcript indicates that he proposed settling this matter by agreeing to the first and middle name change, but not the last name, not the surname. But his testimony in the transcript is centered on opposition to a change in the first and middle name, and he does not mention the surname. So not entirely clear to me, but in any event, the transcript shows that it's
Mr. Valen, if I can follow up on, just to make sure I understand what you're saying, you said that there was some settlement negotiations and during that time his position was only opposed to the last name, or was that something in the transcript that was presented as evidence in this case?
No, this matter was tried to a referee. The referee I won't say required, but urged us to see whether there's any way to resolve this thing. And the transcript, prior to the taking of testimony, the transcript shows that he was willing to accept a change in the first and middle name.
So I guess that begs the question of whether we can consider those statements made, which are not part of what I'll call the trial record or the record of the contested evidentiary hearing. Typically, there is a categorical rule against, you know, considering settlement negotiations or statements made during settlement. Now, this is a different situation. We're talking about a name change petition. It's not like a civil contract case. But nevertheless, I question whether we can consider those statements that are not part of the contested evidentiary hearing when the appeal is taken from the findings made based on the evidence presented at the contested hearing.
Well, I'm I have kind of a roundabout answer to that question, I guess. I'm urging the court to expand the criteria in a case involving a transgender child to follow somewhat what New Jersey has done, which was one of the elements that the New Jersey court considered was that if consent is not given, the reason for withholding consent. But at the same time, I recognize that these discussions were not part of the testimony. Neither party was under oath at that time. So I'm not basing our argument upon those statements made by Mr. Johnson. That answers the question.
Mr. Valen, going back to the point you just made about the legal standard that prevails in New Jersey, why is the existing Minnesota case law necessarily inadequate for a case such as this? In other words, you know, there's the five-factor test that comes from CMG, and I think that comes from a Supreme Court opinion. I don't have it right in front of me, but is it possible to consider all relevant factors within the framework of the existing five-factor test?
I would agree that it probably is, but I just think a name change for a transgender child presents some different considerations than other such cases. New Jersey. The trial court record included exhibits A and B, which are in my addendum, which are reports from counseling agencies that Oliver has been working with. They make it clear that his diagnosis is gender dysphoria, based upon significant clinical distress that he has suffered. Those exhibits also indicate that treatment for gender dysphoria includes regular and consistent use of the chosen name of the child, together with psychosocial support, which he is now getting from his mother and from the Coleman family. And those reports also indicate that that kind of treatment alleviates the depression and anxiety that they found that Oliver has, in fact, been experiencing. The decision of the trial court begins with the phrase, first and foremost, this case has zero to do with any issue of gender. And obviously, we strongly dispute that. I would characterize this case as having everything to do with gender. And that's why I am suggesting that the criteria include some of the items that the New Jersey court included when they were faced with a similar situation. I think to ignore that issue, to ignore the transgender issue here, is to ignore logic and the facts and the record, which is one of the criteria for finding a clear abuse of discretion. I'm not going to read through my brief. I've included some other points in there that I assume the court will take notice of. But I think the record as a whole shows a picture of a mature 16-year-old who has long identified as a male. He's been conscious of that preference since he was very young, although did not act on it back at that time. The evidence we submit supports a finding that a name change to match his gender identity is not only in his best interest, it's necessitated for his substantial welfare. He's of an age where he rationally...
Mr. Valen, you know, I appreciate the argument you're making. Before I get to kind of what the best interest factors would indicate, I'm wondering what your position is on what best interest analysis did the district court conduct?
Impossible to tell, Your Honor, because the decision. Well,
let's start with the what we can tell, the explicit analysis from the district court, putting aside the possibility that there might be implicit factual findings. What was explicit regarding the best interest factors that you were just making an argument to us about, right? You're going through how long Oliver has identified as a male, et cetera. But before we get to that, I wanted to know what your view of the district court's opinion, what did the district court do in its analysis explicitly regarding the best interest factors?
It was not, the trial court decision does not reveal the court's thinking on any of the statutory factors for best interests. It talks about, it simply doesn't. It doesn't address those factors at all. It makes the conclusion that there was not a showing that the substantial welfare of Oliver necessitated a change by clear and convincing evidence. But the trial court did not address explicitly and individually the best interests factors in the statute.
I'm wondering, counsel, because of that, is there any choice but to reverse and remand to the district court, if that is true, in order to consider the factors, as opposed to reversing and ordering or directing the district court to order a name change?
Well, ordinarily, I would say yes, it should be remanded for that purpose. But to me, the record is so clear that as a matter of law, we have met the clear and convincing standard that a name change is necessary for Oliver's welfare, substantial welfare. I think it's so clear that as a matter of law, the court can find that an order should be entered changing his name. And the alternative, of course, would be remanding to the trial court. But we would prefer the former, obviously. Again, I don't want to simply quote my brief. I think I've made my point. We ask the court to enter such an order or at a minimum remand it to the trial court. Thank you.
Are there other questions from the panel? Well, thank you, Mr. Valen, for your written submissions and your arguments this morning. We will take the matter under advisement and issue an opinion within the statutory timeframe.
Thank you, Your Honor.